Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Bonus episode. Plague, War and Hellfire with Rebecca Radil. Today, I'm delighted to speak with Rebecca Radil. Rebecca is, well, what isn't she? She's a historian of the Stuart dynasty and 17th century Britain, completing a PhD at Royal Holloway. She's an author, and her book, 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire, is just as amazing as you'd expect with a title like that. Her next non-fiction work, God's Throne, is expected out sometime in 2021 or 2022. She's produced history documentaries. She's a podcaster, hosting Killing Time with Rebecca Radil, a wonderfully macabre history podcast. And she's the founder of HistFest, the public history festival. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And I feel that's a really nice introduction. I think you should introduce my everyday now, please. That would be great.
So 1666 is brilliant, in a word. I bought it at the start of lockdown because, unfortunately, it's awfully relevant all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I read it and I loved it and I jumped at the chance to have you on to talk about it. So the subtitle of 1666 nicely divides the book into three themes. Firstly, there's plague. Now, plague was, of course, endemic in Britain and it had been for centuries. So what made the 1665 to 66 outbreak so noteworthy?
It's a really tough question, actually. It's one that I've been asked quite a lot because obviously it's known as the Great Plague. And it's a very, I mean, it was a great plague. Not great as in happy. It was rather huge. But yeah, it's, I think, because it's the final big epidemic that hit England, it's kind of that label has been has remained intact, when in actual fact there were plagues that happened before that point in the 17th century, the early 17th century, which were also known as the Great Plague. So I mean, in a nutshell, it probably killed the highest number of people, but obviously the population had increased since the early 17th century as well. So in a nutshell, I suppose there were 100,000 people, we think, died of plague during that period in London predominantly, and that was out of a population of around 450,000 people. So it's, and obviously there were, you know, there was another portion of that population that had the plague and survived as well. So it was a really widespread problem and something that affected every person's life, particularly in the capital.
So once the reports, obviously there'd been reports of the plague on the continent, but once the reports of plague deaths in England reached the authorities, how did they react?
Well, to start with, obviously, as you mentioned in your question, plague was endemic in England during this time. So there were, you know, there were one or two deaths from plague across the country pretty much every year. So I guess having one plague death is not necessarily a remarkable thing. It's when these numbers start to increase. So the authorities, when they got wind of these cases, the ones that we know about and are documented, seem to have originated in St Giles in the Fields, which is a parish outside the walls of the city walls of London, and measures were put in place. And we've all heard about the idea of houses being shut up, and particularly at the moment we're very aware with about self-isolation and things. So if somebody was found to have plague, then their house was shut up, and that basically means it was locked up. The people were not allowed to leave the premises, everybody within that household, not necessarily just the person that had plague. And they were quarantined there for 40 days. And you do get some instances in the historical records and the archives of people, you know, actually defying these rules and breaking out of quarantine. And one particular case that happened in St Giles in the Fields, Charles II was made aware of, and he asked that they be dealt with in the most severest way. And now plague punishments for public disorder during plague time have a long history, and in actual fact, and you see this particularly in the plays and pamphlets that were written in the early 17th century, plague outbreaks were often associated in the public conscience with public disorder and the breakdown of order. So plays like The Alchemist, pamphlets by people such as Thomas Dekker, they talk about particular places being almost where order has just gone awry, and people are doing anything that they want, and it's interesting this association, and some of the punishments for wandering around the street when you know you have plague were very severe. So they included things like whipping, public whipping, and other unsavoury things that would not be acceptable in 2020.
Maybe not the brightest idea to start whipping the person with plague sores.
Yeah, probably not the best of ideas, really, to be honest. But I mean, we jest, but it was obviously to create an example to scare people, other people from doing similar things. So it's kind of extreme punishment in the hope that it would put everybody else off. But yeah, not particularly pleasant.
I think what struck me reading it was how apocalyptic it seemed.
Hmm.
You do a fantastic job of illustrating what London was like after people fled in their thousands, and there'd be a few physicians who decided to stay, but otherwise parts of London were like a ghost town. That's really, really interesting, and it just makes the fact that people were, even then, even in apocalyptic conditions, breaking the rules.
Yes.
People just don't change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they do, really. And isn't it weird how what's been going on recently has given, well, me as a historian of plague, it's given me a greater insight into how people must have been feeling and thinking that I just did not appreciate beforehand. The process of doing the same things every day. So early on in lockdown, when I was getting shopping, like lots of people, I was making sure I was sanitizing my hands after putting the shopping away and all of that. And then it made me reflect on the processes in place during plague time, because people believed then that vinegar was would prevent the spread of the miasma, because plague was believed to have been spread by miasma, which, if you're not aware of, it's a Galenic theory that means that things are spread by bad air. There's good air and there's bad air, and bad air carries disease and contagion. So they used vinegar on letters as they were being posted to different places in the city. And it was just a process of using vinegar. And it just makes you think these kind of like mundane everyday things that you get so used to, you don't really appreciate how much of a toll they actually do take on your day. And it did make me think about the things like putting vinegar on letters and stuff.
So the war of plague, war and hellfire is, of course, the Second Anglo-Dutch War. Can you go into a bit more detail about why that war broke out?
So the Second Anglo-Dutch War, as is implied by its title, was the second of three actual wars between the English and the Dutch Republic. Now, there's lots of reasons for the various causes of each of the three individual wars, but one common theme throughout all of them is that it was kind of, they were wars about colonialism, I suppose, and trade wars and trying to get monopoly on certain places, key locations along the West African coast and then simultaneously along the American coastline as well. They were locked into the slave trade, particularly the Second Anglo-Dutch War, which, even though it broke out in 1665, there had been tensions and mini kind of skirmishes, I suppose, in 1664. A man named Robert Holmes, who features in the book, and I won't give too much away about him, but he is basically a horrible man. So he was in charge of raiding several bases along the West African coast to try and take control so that they could... so that they could then control the trade with West Africa. Now, it's important to say here that he and subsequent sailors and commanders were commissioned by the Royal Africa Company. And the Royal Africa Company was a state-backed company that were explicitly tasked with, firstly, looking for gold. Now, that was a main priority in 1665, but also explicitly as well in the terms was an interest in looking for slaves as well and trying to get a foothold in the slave trade in a more, in a much bigger way. So that's one thing that's really important to know about these Anglo-Dutch wars, because you can't separate them from the wider world. Having said that, in terms of the actual process of the wars and in terms of the actual engagements, it was all at sea, but it was mainly focused around the North Sea and the English Channel. So it was around those areas, and obviously with the war being between the English and the Dutch, these fights were quite close to the coastlines most of the time, and people could actually hear the firing of cannon fire. They gathered news very quickly, because you'd have these huge warships which carry hundreds of men on board, but then you'd have these smaller little boats that were tasked with coming back and forwards with supplies, but also taking back information to the mainland, which would then be carried probably by a messenger, which was usually an aristocrat, to be honest, but a young one. The Earl of Rochester, famous now for writing dirty poetry, was engaged in these wars, and he often played messenger. But they would bring back information that would then be taken to the king and the City of London, where they could assess how things were going. So these were naval. It was a naval war with most of the battles fought at sea. But it was a really big deal at the time. And these wars have kind of been forgotten, I think, possibly because there aren't any recognisable heroes on the English side. So obviously with Trafalgar and the Napoleonic Wars, we do think of Nelson. He's a big name that we can remember. But with the Anglo-Dutch Wars, we don't really have the same kind of figure during this time, which is quite possibly a good thing.
But there still were events which caught the public eye at the time and are still memorable today.
Yeah, so obviously, there was probably five or six main battles that took place. One of the earliest ones, the Battle of Lowestoft, was a victory for the English. And boy, didn't they like talking about it. It was an early victory, and the Duke of York, James, the Duke of York, who was Charles II's brother and was also the future James II, he was in charge of this battle, and it was a victory. He was very close to death during this time, because there were cannons being fired left, right and centre, and people next to him had their, bodies torn apart and perished as a result of the war, and he managed to survive. So that was a major battle that stayed in public imagination, and there were portraits and paintings made afterwards commemorating the commanders that had been in charge. There were another series of battles as well. But then I think the most famous one in terms of impact and posterity is perhaps, quite possibly, the raid on the Medway, which actually happened in 1667. And this was where the Dutch actually invaded England and took away the prize warship, the Royal Charles. And you can still see part of it in a museum in Amsterdam today.
So despite some early victories, the war as a whole doesn't go well for the English. So what was the legacy of the Second Anglo-Dutch War.
The legacy is, again, another tricky one. It was unfinished business. The First War was unfinished business because nothing was actually resolved. They might have won the war, but there was still the wider issue of you know, the wider world and the lust for gold and the money that could be accrued with slaves. I mean, that was a continuing situation globally. So it doesn't matter if you win a war when you're in a commercial rivalry with another country, because that rivalry is still going to be there. And that's why we see a series of three wars break out. The third one, the actual events that led up to war and the battles that followed, was more political, and it was more down to Charles II doing deals with Louis XIV in France. And he kind of so there was this daft rule that any ship that goes along the channel has to salute to an English warship. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a kind of ego thing on the English part. So Dutch ships, I mean, most people largely, you know, adhered to this rule. Dutch ships, French ships, they would salute the English ships. But Charles knew this, and he sent a ship that wasn't technically a warship, so it didn't technically have to be saluted. But he sent a ship, more like a boat actually, into a melee of Dutch ships, and they didn't salute, and he used this as an act of war and started a war with the Dutch. But it was all down to politics and rivalry between Louis XIV and the Prince of Orange at the time as well. So I mean, they're all complicated, but as I say, they're all mainly rooted in commercial rivalry and the politics of power on the northern continent as well.
So that's the war polished off.
Yep.
So what about Hellfire? The Great Fire of London. The incredibly famous event where Samuel Pepys buried his cheese. That's the one thing that everyone seems to know about. But could you give us a brief rundown of the fire? How did it begin? How long it burned? What kind of damage did it cause?
Okay. So the fire broke out in early September of 1666, and we know this story from school. We all know what happened. It broke out in Thomas Farriner's bakehouse. Whether it was he who had left his oven on, or whether it was his daughter, I don't know. I would like to think it might have been might not have been him actually, but anyway, we don't know. So the fire broke out. It spread very quickly along Pudding Lane. The measures that could have perhaps prevented it spreading were not put in place straight away. And these measures included pulling down surrounding houses. And this was a tried and tested method. It worked. If you had a fire, you create a fire break to pull down the houses around it, and it will stop the spread. But the Lord Mayor, the Mayor of London, he didn't do this. And there are various reasons why. Firstly, he was slightly inept. But secondly, he didn't own the buildings. They were owned by external people, and London was a city of landlords and tenants. So even if he'd been able to get hold of the people that were living in the house at the time and in time, they wouldn't have been able to give him permission to pull these buildings down. So that didn't happen. So the fire spread very quickly along Pudding Lane, then made its way down towards the River Thames and along Thames Street. And this was an area that had lots of combustible goods. So oil, alcohol, fish, meats, all those types of things. And it kind of erupted big style when it got there and spread across most of the city of London over the ensuing four and a half days. In terms of damage, if you look at maps, maps of the city immediately following the fire, you can see how the city of London, which is the walled section of London, you can see how that's largely been destroyed. There's 80% of that part of the city was eradicated, basically. And yeah, I mean, it was a really traumatic event for everybody that was witnessing it. Samuel Pepys, in his diary, gives a really vivid account of the progress of the fire, including all the different buildings and significant buildings for people living in the city at the time that were being destroyed, and the kind of financial district was destroyed as well, but the bankers were prioritised in a way, and they were given space to work in the buildings that usually house the Royal Society, Gresham College, much to the annoyance of the members of the Royal Society. So, you know, those were things that were important to people at the time, but then bigger buildings that we associate with historic London, like Old St Paul's Cathedral, we know was ruined. The Guildhall was badly damaged. Loads of churches. To be honest, there were probably too many churches in London at that time anyway, but loads of them were destroyed. Just shy of 90, actually, were destroyed. And then also buildings that we may have slightly forgotten about today. So Baynard's Castle, which was a massive building on the riverfront, which had been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it was a significant location that was destroyed as well. So it did feel apocalyptic, and you mentioned that word before, but it did feel that way to the people witnessing the fire at the time, and the way that it's been described as, you know, as it's almost supernatural, the way the fire was progressing and the shapes that it was creating in the sky.
I actually found reading 1666 that, much like when you're describing the spread of the plague, when you're describing the Great Fire, it was just so engaging. I couldn't put the book down.
I think anyone that writes history, you want to make it readable, and I absolutely love fiction. I should flag that all my work is rooted in historical fact and archival research, none of it is fiction, but I like looking for those things that can draw people in. So, you know, if there is any small reference to what was going on visually, I like to include that, because I think it helps to paint a picture of big events in people's minds. Because, you know, things like a great plague and a great fire, they're things that most of us will never experience. And even now, I mean, with coronavirus, we feel like we've lived through, a large scale epidemic, and we have, but it's nothing when you compare it to the Great Plague. Absolutely nothing. When you think of the sheer number of, you know, the sheer proportion of people that were dying as a result of the Great Plague, it's something that's almost unimaginable. And the same goes for the Great Fire of London. To see an entire city burn, who will experience that? I mean, it's not something that we can really imagine. Perhaps war zones, there'd be a comparisons there, but it's these were huge events in people's lives, and they did look to, you know, they looked to God and religion to try and make sense of it. You know, what had they done to cause these things? What were they being punished for? Whose fault was it? I think if you can make it visual, I think that's an important thing when writing history.
I think what also helps keep the reader engaged, and it certainly kept me hooked, was the way the book follows certain individuals. You have Pepys, of course, but you also write about other people who haven't left the same mark on history that Pepys did. One group you look at are a merchant family who plan to marry their daughter to the son of another family, but then that son dies in the plague, and so his younger brother takes his place. And you just follow these two families through this absolutely calamitous couple of years, and it really brings home the reality of these events.
Yeah, and I think the family you're referring to, the Mitchells, I confess, I found them. This is the thing. When you're writing about the Restoration, you are blessed with Samuel Pepys's diary. Like, you cannot ignore the richness of that source material. You cannot be complacent when you're thinking about your own period, when you know that you've got Samuel Pepys as a source for Restoration London, because he gives such a great guided tour of the city. But it's important to remember that it's through his eyes, and his eyes were his eyes. He's not typical of that time, and you should never think that one person is typical of any time, because we're all different. We're all individuals, and we've all got our own flaws and interests and passions. So it's always important to remember that, because it's such a rich source that you could be tempted to use, you know, rely too much on that. But what Pepys does offer is hints and clues about other people's lives that are lower down the social order. So the Mitchells do pop up in Pepys's diary, and you can use his references to unravel their life stories. So as soon as I got the names from his diary, I was then able to go into the parish records and see what else I could find out. I was then able to look through Early English Books Online, which is a great online resource, which does what it says on the tin. It has all the books that were printed and published that we found and we know about online. So I could see what books might have been sold in the, you know, from the Mitchells or any other, you know, other merchants that were living and operating in London at that time that may have been mentioned in passing in Pepys's diary. So it's, yeah, it's detective work. But then, you know, as a historian, it is all detective work, isn't it? And that's part of the joy of doing it. But if you can shine a light on quote unquote ordinary people's lives, then I think it helps create a better picture of what the world might have been like, rather than just looking to, you know, a couple of high profile individuals.
So once the fires were successfully put out eventually and the rebuilding began, who was blamed for the fire? Did they know that the fire had started in Pudding Lane?
They did have a sense that it came from Pudding Lane while the fire was going on, and they also had a sense that it came from a bakehouse, and They got the location of the bakehouse wrong on a couple of occasions. Other bakeries were blamed. but yeah, they did know where the epicentre was. They certainly knew that. But there was also a feeling, and you see in the descriptions of the Great Fire, there was a feeling that it was an act of arson as well. And to be perfectly honest, you can kind of understand why this, you know, these rumours were going round. Firstly, they were at war, that England was at war with the Dutch and also the French. I mean, I mentioned the French before, but they were at war with the French technically as well, because the French were on the Dutch side due to an earlier agreement. That's very complicated. But so there were natural foreign enemies to be fearful of. But then the way that the fire progressed, huge chunks of debris were flying through the air and landing quite far away from, you know, from where they'd broken away. So it did seem as though the fire was breaking out in multiple locations, and it didn't quite make sense how that could be happening. But obviously there was a strong wind blowing across the city, so this probably helped these pieces of debris fly further than they would have done ordinarily. So blame, let's get back to that. That was your question. So anyone with a foreign sounding accent was at risk during the fire. This was as all times in history, this was a really xenophobic period of time. There were violent attacks on anybody that sounded like they didn't come from London originally. That some of these attacks, I mean, all of the attacks are really dark. Some of them are really, really dark. Now, I don't know who your listeners are, so feel free to cut this one out. But there's one account of a woman having her breasts cut off because they thought that she was carrying firebombs, I suppose, in her dress, when actual fact it was just a chicken. These are strange accounts. The accounts of men being dismembered. It's very graphic and not very pleasant to read. So any foreign born person was blamed. More broadly, people blame themselves. As I said before, they were looking to God and to religion and thinking about what they might have done themselves to cause this punishment, and they included the three things. They included the war, the Great Plague, and the Great Fire of London in their sins. They were seen as three parts of the same thing. And there were various, you know, reasons for this blame as well. So that it was either them sinning personally, it was Charles II whose court was being licentious and sinful, or it was perhaps punishment for the regicide of Charles I, which had happened a decade or so earlier. They found a man who was basically used as a scapegoat. He said that he'd started the fire, and he managed to lead the authorities to the location of the outbreak of the fire, and he did this correctly. But looking back at the records now, it seems as though he was probably at sea at the time that the fire broke out, so he didn't do it. Why he confessed, I don't know. You often get strange confessions in history, don't you? For crimes, I'm not sure whether Yeah, we don't know why he confessed to that, to starting the fire. But in any case, he was tried, found guilty, and executed as a result. Thomas Farriner got off scot-free. He was fine. He carried on trading afterwards. So yeah, I mean, but then people were still thinking about the fire for a long time after. It was something that stayed in people's minds. Pepys, in his diary, talks about having nightmares about the fire as well. It was a really formative and monumental episode in the lives of pretty much anyone that lived through it.
One of the things that I do remember from school, and it's quite striking considering the scale of the fire, but famously, only a few people are officially on the death toll.
Hmm. Yeah.
As I've learnt in your book, that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, and I do think if anyone tells you they know how many people died during the Great Fire, they're lying, because we can't know. We cannot know. And even just going through the records myself, like, you can see there are themes that don't make sense. The number of elderly people dying in the week of the fire, for example, shoots up. So it doesn't make sense. And then there appear to be no, you know, in other records there are no deaths of small children that week. Well, that doesn't make sense because they're always there. So if they're not present in the records, where are they? There are curiosities when it comes to the fire. And what I tend to think about, what I look to, even though it was a couple of centuries later, the Great Fire of Chicago was very similar in its makeup. It was very similar in the population of the city at the time. It was a wooden city, in terms of the duration of the fire as well. And what we see from the Great Fire of Chicago, and the records were kept better then, is that a few hundred people, 200 or 300 people, died during that fire. And I would guess, and again, this is absolutely a guess, that the casualties of the Great Fire of London probably sits closer to that than the, you know, half a dozen that's often said.
So moving on to slightly less morbid topic. One of the things that really struck me, outside of the themes of plague, war and hellfire, one of the things that struck me reading 1666 was the relationship between King Charles II and the future James VII and II. Because on Pax Britannica, we've looked at Elizabeth, we've looked at James, and we've looked at Charles I. None of them, when they come to the throne, have siblings. And so I found the fact that Charles is king, and his brother, who is increasingly looking like his heir, is also around. And I think that's really interesting. I wonder if you could tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, it is interesting. So when Charles takes the throne, and obviously there's a huge caveat here because he had been declared King of Scotland, you know, way before. But when the Restoration happens in 1660, he does have siblings, and it's not just James. He has, you know, brother, sister as well. And it's interesting to think about that dynamic and the way that it works. Certainly his sister, who was in France, you know, was a good diplomat, I suppose. She was able to pass on messages and send things back to her brother. In terms of James and Charles specifically, they were very different men, very different in so many ways, but similar in others. In intellect, I think that's the most glaring difference between the two. I think they were both, you know, they both had similar educations, but Charles was canny. Charles was sharp, and I think he was very good at manipulating people in a subtle way, whereas James was a bit more brash. He kind of wore his heart and his brain on his sleeve, and was very stubborn, whereas Charles was more pliable and open to changing his mind and views should it be, you know, should he think it was, you know, would help him in the long term. So you've got that difference in personality, which is key, and you can see it. You can see, without being too crass about it, you can see how it plays out in their respective reigns as well. I think if James, I mean, this is getting into counterfactual history now, but if James had been the king during, you know, if he had been the king at the point of the Restoration, would the monarchy have managed to ride through the Great Plague and the Great Fire and the Anglo-Dutch Wars as easily, well, relatively easily as they had with Charles. I'm not so sure. So that you've got that. But then also, they were loyal as well. So while they had these huge differences, and they certainly had fallouts over mistresses as well as everything else. And, you know, court was very political, but it was very political and also emotional. There were affairs going on left, right and centre between people that were related, you know, fathers and sons, fathers and sons going after the same mistress. Yeah, it was a very small world. So you had all these rivalries, but then equally, as we know, Charles was very loyal to his brother. So when the exclusion crisis reared its head in the late 1670s, early 1680s, he was adamant that James would be his heir. It was never going to be the Duke of Monmouth, who was Charles II's illegitimate firstborn son, who was a Protestant. James had declared himself to be Catholic. And that was, I should say, and that was the root of the exclusion crisis. They had an interesting dynamic, which was loyal at its heart to one another, but equally they had huge differences in personality.
The Restoration Court was infamous for its, in the language of the time, the immoral behaviour, the debauchery and all of that kind of thing. And you mentioned him earlier, Rochester. He's out there penning terribly dirty poems about the goings-on. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit curious about how this was received in early modern society, especially after the Cromwellian regime.
Yeah, I think what we often do is we separate periods from one another too severely. There's a tendency to separate 1660 from 1659. So there were lots of threads that ran through, even from Cromwell's time. Culturally, London didn't change overnight, and it didn't change that much in some respects as well. But in terms of a royal court that was flaunting affairs quite openly, that was new. That was a fresh development. Obviously, kings throughout and queens throughout history had had affairs. They'd had love affairs, and they'd done things that may have been viewed as immoral at the time. But to do it publicly was a different kettle of fish. And that's what Charles was doing, and that's what James was doing, and that's what the rest of the court was doing as well. So there was a kind of honeymoon period with Charles II from 1660 until the disasters of the mid-1660s. And then after that, the populace tended to be a little bit more critical. Now, I want to say that with caution, because obviously most people living in England wouldn't have really cared at all about what was going on with the royal court. Most people lived in rural villages. They were, farmers still. So we're talking about urban chatter and chatter between aristocrats here. And when I say urban, it's predominantly London as well. So in response to Charles's multiple affairs, there was an interesting thing called the bawdy house riots in 1668, where apprentices rioted against lots of brothels in London and demanding entry. Now, this wasn't an attack on the morals of brothels. This was more because the proprietors had put up their rates to such a level that the apprentices couldn't afford to have their time with a prostitute. So that's why they were rioting. But out of this, you get pamphlets that are written to a Lady Castlemaine, who was Charles II's chief mistress at this time, aligning her with the prostitutes and talking to her as their sister. So it's interesting that there was almost a freedom to be able to be critical of the court in this way in pamphlets, and people weren't shy of being critical. Now, I think, that you still had to be cautious because you were criticising the king. But one person that was able to get around this, and I think it's a really interesting example, was, as you said, the Earl of Rochester, because he was on the inside, but he was able to be critical as well. And now we often just think of his poetry as dirty poetry, and in truth, a lot of it actually is. But it was satirical as well, and I think that's something that we need to remember. He was someone that was able to write these awful, dirty poems that are critical of the king, but actually do it and get away with it. And I think that's an interesting development. So yeah, I mean, there were reactions to Charles Court and his licentiousness.
How widely were these distributed? Were they just kept within the court as like kind of in-jokes? Or did they make their way to a printer?
They were pinned up in key locations. So in London, you had the key places where notices were put up. So one was the gates of Whitehall or the gates of Westminster. And they were read there by crowds and people gathering round. The other thing to say as well, which I probably should have said before, is that the court was made a really bad name for itself when it was in Oxford during the Great Plague. And there was an Oxford academic, Anthony Wood, who wrote about their time there and wrote how they were all basically the only thing they were bothered about was the clothes that they were wearing and wearing nicer fashions than one another, and also who was having a love affair with who. And the other thing that he said, which is rather disgusting, is how that they were basically shitting in the houses that they were staying in, but like in the rooms, not in the loos. So there's that as well that I should have probably mentioned. And actually, while they were in Oxford, there was a notice put up about Charles's mistress, Lady Castlemaine, again saying that the reason that she wasn't ducked, which means a ducking stool that was used for women, so the reason that she wasn't ducked was because by the king she was fucked. And that just gives you an insight into how people were thinking about the court at the time.
So for your next project, God's Throne, mm-hmm. can you tell us something about that?
I can tell you a little bit about that. So God's Throne is a big history, so that's why it's taken me a while to write it. But it's about the Stuarts. Well, it's a history of the Stuart dynasty from 1603 to 1714, and it looks at the family through the lens of power and the interplay with Parliament, but also because I just love the histories of ordinary people as well, that flows throughout it too. So it's a big sweeping history. I hope people like it when it's done. It's taken a lot of work, and yes, I mean, I'm enjoying still writing it, but it's not ready to be released just yet.
Well, when it is, that's a pre-order from me, guaranteed.
Oh, great. One customer.
And if it could come out before I get past 1714, that would be even better.
Yeah, sure.
So for listeners who are catching this interview the day it comes out or a few days after, on the 23rd of September 2020, Rebecca is giving a talk at the Fellows online on the regicide of Charles I. Now, Rebecca, would you be able to very briefly sell listeners on why they should come along to your talk?
Well, if you like kings having their heads chopped off, and if you like the power of the people, then this is the talk for you. No, it's I'm basically looking at the regicide, the events that led up to the regicide of Charles I. What actually happened during the trial, and we have some beautiful trial transcripts that still exist, and then also its legacy and the way that Charles has been represented throughout time. It's quite a fun, if I can say that word, talk, and hopefully it gives a bit of a flavour of the situation in England during those heady mid 17th century years.
Well, such a peaceful, quiet time, not much else happening. I'll leave a link to that talk in the description of this episode. £5 a ticket. Bargain. With that, thank you so much for coming on, Rebecca. This has been amazing.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'll definitely have to get you on to talk about God's Throne when that's on its way out.
Yeah, in about 30 years.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Rebecca Radil for coming on to speak with me. You can find 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire at all good bookshops, and I'll leave a link in the description to this episode. There's so much more in 1666 that we didn't talk about. The important role of espionage and spycraft during the war, the diplomatic games played between the belligerent powers, the flourishing theatre culture, the lawless wasteland of post-fire London with its ruins and cellars full of murders in the dark, and how modern London could have looked vastly different. With Christmas on the horizon, 1666 might just be the perfect gift for someone you know. I wholeheartedly recommend it for anyone interested in the period, or just for those who'd like a reminder that no matter how terrible things may seem, it could always be worse.
There will also be a link to register for the Regicide talk for £5, which again is on the 23rd of September at 6 p.m. British Summer Time. If you're not able to make it, or you're only hearing this after it's happened, then you can also purchase the recording of the event for only £3. It promises to be a fantastic event, and if there's any questions you wish I'd asked Rebecca now, there's your chance. Thank you to my House of Lords, which has a new face in Yannick, Viscount Stiller. A veteran peer, Christopher Burton, has ascended the social scale and is now the Earl of Worcester. They are joining my royal favourites, Andrew Shoemaker and Mike Sanders, the Duchess of Devon, Michelle Gersich, the Royal Headsman, executed today, the Duke of Clarence, Rory Martin, the Duke of Ormond, Brendan Bonner. Thank you to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.